Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Oh, there's Barnes Courtney.
I'm so sorry. I'm so late. I didn't even know I had this today.
It's fine. We were talking about all sorts of stuff. Somebody saw on TikTok, I guess, they asked, did I see the big baby? And I guess it was an adult baby in a crib.
They refer to that. I mean, I suppose I am a man child. I never thought of myself as a baby.
Oh, they weren't calling you that. We were just talking about...
I feel like... Sometimes I put on various different baby attire. Yes, but I don't call myself a baby when I do it. It's more of a private thing that I do alone in my bedroom.
All right. Well, you're in your bedroom now. Can you get on your baby outfit?
Okay. I call it a baby outfit. It's pretty much just nude. So.
That's awesome. Barnes is getting naked.
Yeah, well, I have to make money somehow. You know, I can't tour anymore.
Yeah, I know. Is that kind of depressing that you can't go out and tour and do what you do?
No, because I can sell my body on the internet.
All right. That's
also what I do.
How much does your body go for, Barnes?
Not a lot. Not a lot of money in it. I don't want to give it away for free.
Yeah.
That's just a taste. Get a taste.
You talked about this before. Are moms still, in 2020, in love with you?
Well, here's what I think about that and the mom situation. I think that most artists don't make time for the moms. But moms know that Barnes Courtney has a lot of love for all manner of ladies and gentlemen and people who identify as neither. So the mom, they don't even like my music. They're just like, you know what? I'm a mom. I know I'll be appreciated at the Barnes gig. Yeah. I'll be there.
You're a very cool dude. You're laid back. You're fun. Even after you do, at our festival, you went out and you partied with the fans. You'd rather see that. I mean, you don't really see that ever. And it's really cool to, you know, see an artist actually hang out with their fans right next to them drinking. And
well, that's how I lull them into a false sense of security. And then eventually it's like, bam, aha, I've got your kidney.
I'm in your life.
The party, contrary to popular belief, is actually out in the festival.
Yeah.
With all the people having time. And everyone, you know, thinks that it's cool to watch bands from backstage. And in a way, like it is, for, I guess, you know, if you're into status and stuff, but the whole festival was designed to be enjoyed from in front of the stage.
Yeah.
You know, like everything is centered around the audience and the people out there. So that's where the fun is. And yeah, you know, it's sure, you know, pop a couple of Quaaludes and snort some mescaline off an old man's tits.
What is this, sure, the 70s? You know, Quaaludes?
Hi, look at my hair. Sure, that's fun, but I always have the best time when I go out and enjoy the festival properly.
We'll take a question from one of the fans here that are joining us on Socially Distant, Audrey Barkov. Hi, Barnes. I love your music, and I'm from Russia. When will your new album be out?
Oh, from Russia. Осторожно, двери закрываются.
See?
Be careful, the door's closing. What did she ask?
She asked, when will the new album be out?
We're working on it right now. We built a studio in my parents' house. We left London to escape the COVIDs.
Yeah.
Gam.
Hey.
My guitar player, Gam.
What's up? Good
Very
to see you, man.
Saucy today.
How are you doing during these crazy days?
Doing all right, man. How's the album coming over there?
Pretty awesome, to be honest. Every day we're waking up, we spend here some time in the studio, we write some tunes, we produce some stuff, enjoying the sun, feeding birds. That's our new hobby.
Yes, I have found a new friend called Julian, who is a small white pigeon that I successfully fed from my hand today.
Congratulations.
He is above the other bird. He's not content to simply scrape and scratch around like any common pigeon of the hackle. He is... have you got a picture?
Yeah, let me see. Oh, wow.
There he is.
The white one, that's Julian.
Julian!
Look at Julian. Look at that. All the other birds are jealous, not getting as much attention.
They are, and he's quite... I like him because he's quite aloof.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't, like, hang around garden for very long. He kind of comes in, he'll take a few seeds, and then he'll leave. And the other pigeons will fight and sort of scrape and scratch about.
I have that on camera as well.
Yeah. The people want to know, Gavin. That's why they came. They came to hear about my animal husbandry.
Will Julian be a part of the new album? Will the pigeon be a part of the new album?
Yes. There's going to be every show. I'm going to release several cagefuls of Julians into the audience.
So you're saying you're going to breed Julians?
I'm going to breed pigeons.
Are your parents kind of excited that you're kind of famous?
Oh.
Not
I don't know, man. I mean, I have an interesting level of fame, which I quite enjoy.
Yeah.
Like, when I actually go to play one of my gigs, I can sort of feel as though I'm relatively famous because everyone, you know, all the three people and their dog that came to see me all know that it's me. And then when I go home, I kind of can live in total anonymity, which is great.
Yeah.
I feel bad, you know, you get a sense as an artist, even on my level, of what it must be like to be someone like Billie Eilish. You know, like for instance, the festival, you know, when you've just played the stage, right, you can't walk for more than 2 feet without getting stopped. And of course, you're very grateful to everybody. You want to talk to everybody because they are literally the lifeblood of the project.
Yeah.
But it's easy for me to deal with that. You know, I can spend like 6-8 hours talking to fans at a festival because I only have to do it the once, you know, and then I'm off. Whereas if you're somebody like Billie Eilish or, you know, on that level of fame, can you imagine you just every single day of your life just inundated with people who want to chat?
It's scary.
And the moment that you're exhausted and tired, they're like, oh, my God, he's kind of an asshole, you know?
Yeah.
It's a very difficult life.
And then you have magazines. You have who reads magazines, James? You have websites. You have the media. You know, if you happen to have a bad day.
Valid format.
Masculine magazines, newspapers.
Okay, fine, whatever.
Are you afraid of getting that famous? Because it does sound scary.
I don't know, not really. I mean, I think fame is such a byproduct, you know?
Yeah.
The ironic thing is that they want it, but actually it's sort of, you know, why do people crave fame? It's because they crave love, really, on a base level, and acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't really get any of those things from fame. When people come and speak to you after a show, it's impossible to have real fulfilling interactions with people when you're placed on a pedestal, mm-hmm. when you can't interact with them on an equal footing. You know, and I've tried. I've said to people before, I'm like, you know, it's all just an illusion, right? Just all lights and, you know, fancy things. And like,
yeah.
I know that people are all singing along, but you know, it's all just sort of smoke and mirrors. And they're visibly crestfallen and disillusioned. Like, they don't want me to tell them that.
Yeah.
They want to be like, no, I'm a space alien. I'm the second coming of Jesus Christ. Look at me. I'm the Sugar Plum Fairy. And the best part about all this is that incredible moment where social barriers are broken down and you and the crowd become much closer as strangers. And not just the artist and the audience, but the audience amongst themselves as well. And you have this magnificent occurrence where you can literally get down and rub your sweaty head against somebody else. And it's like totally cool. And, you know, they're all out there, all hearts beating, all dancing, you know, singing hallelujah. It's wonderful. And it transcends the human experience in such an incredible, ethereal way. And so then you finish the show and you come off stage and people think, wow, that was incredible. I want to touch that. And what they don't realize is that the moment you stepped off the stage, you just become a normal person again.
Yeah.
And they become a stranger, mm-hmm. you know?
Was there do you remember the first time you were on stage and the crowd all sang along to a song that you wrote?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember specifically the exact first time, but I remember it was around my first, I don't know, I've played a lot of very shitty shows, and I've been very shitty, I played a gig every weekend, you know, in my great-grandmother's blouse and a pair of Lycra skinny pants, like blue and black stripes.
Ooh.
It was pretty solid. And yeah, so I remember people singing along, but they were like our friends because the only people that would come to gigs were our friends. And
yeah.
It's kind of like suffer through a Barnes Courtney gig and get to hang out with your friends and drink.
Yeah.
Now, I remember on this project specifically being like, you know, pretty blown away by the fact that anyone knew the lyrics to my tunes.
Yeah, it's got to be a great feeling, right?
Yeah, it's I don't know.
I mean, you wrote those words, and then you have, you know, thousands of people or hundreds of people singing along. It's got to be a good feeling.
Good feeling. It's sort of like less of a like, haha, I am great. It's very humbling, if that makes sense. It kind of makes you feel a bit sort of fragile and vulnerable, and you're like, oh God, you know, what's this thing that's happened? And like, you know, it's nice and moving, but it certainly, I don't know, for me anyway, it sometimes knocks me down a few pegs, and I'm like, oh God. I remember one tour when I was really, really struggling, and we just lost money consistently tour after tour for years, right?
Yeah.
And it was really hard, and like, you know, I wasn't sure if I'd be able to carry on. I was exhausted, and I played this show in Boston, and everybody, like the whole crowd, just really fucking brought it that night. Like it was, you know, it like brought tears to my eyes. They were just so in, the energy was so enormous, you know.
Yeah.
And I went back after the show, and you know, I don't do encores because I think they're cheesy, and you know, people expect them. And they started cheering for an encore, and you know, they went on for like 2 minutes, and they were stomping and clapping, and I went out and did one more song, and it, for some reason, it just really hit me, like, wow, you know, none of this was ever about me. It's about us as a collective. It's about connecting and coming to shows, and it's about giving ourselves a moment's rest to join together in this shared illusion. And to make that whole process just about myself is a little bit arrogant, you know, and ungrateful. And then after the show, I went out and spoke to everybody, and it was just like such an amazing atmosphere, you know, like everyone's coming up and, you know, hugging me, and we're all like, you know, people are crying. I don't know what it was about that. It was just a very magical night.
And it's kind of crazy. Isn't it weird how things kind of lined up? You know, everything was kind of down for you, and then you go and do this show, and your fans are there, and everybody comes together and kind of lifts you up in a time of need.
It's very easy, I think, in this business to compare yourself to, because there's always somebody bigger, isn't there? You know, I remember even the singer from the Dandy Warhols was complaining about how he wasn't as big as like the Rolling Stones, and that's what he always wanted. But you know, like for me, I have the most fans, but I do have the best fans.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's go back a little bit earlier in your career. You had a record label drop you after you made an album. How do you not let something like that defeat you?
I think depression can be a very low energy state, but I think when you really hit rock bottom, it can also be a tremendous catalyst for change. Mm-hmm. When you can't go any lower, and you know, I was low because I'd only experienced this upward trajectory in my music since I started my first band at 14. Mm-hmm. It was like, you know, like winning Battle of Bands and getting on to televised shows with my band, and like my first manager went to LA to record my album. And everyone promised me, and I was young and naive. Everyone was like, you're going to be a big star. And like, I had Lady Gaga's producer, Red One, and it was the first time I'd ever even been in a record label. And I just, you know, I was a teenager, and I really, really just thought, if people say that the project is massive and they work for Universal Records, then it must be, right? Like,
yeah.
How could they be working this big fancy building with a rotating globe outside? Mm-hmm. You know, so to get dropped like that and go from having never really known real life and real struggle, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. Everything that I believed about myself and my destiny and who I was supposed to be was like just totally pulled out from under me. And I went from having all my meals paid for by the label and my rent and not worried about anything to suddenly working odd jobs for like PC World or selling cigarettes in a polyester blue suit in nightclubs, like a piece of World War II eye candy. And I think I definitely went through the seven stages. Is seven stages?
I think it's seven. Yeah. Or five. Five.
Psychologist. And I think I got to the point where I was just in this like kicking, screaming, raging denial, like of circumstance. Like, no, this can't be my life. So fuck this. This cannot be how it ends. You know, I can't just live like this. And I think it was more the fact that I was so desperately unhappy not being a musician, more than was willpower and determination that lifted me out of that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for some friends, some of my best friends are really happy doing exactly what they do and living life in a small town. And I love them for that. I think that's great.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I guess when it's in you, you got to do it. And it was bad. I was living off like 5 pounds a day, eating tin sardines, you know, because it was like the healthiest thing I could find.
Yeah.
But I'm really grateful for that experience, because without it, I wouldn't have had anything real to write about. And it was the first time ever in my life that I'd ever written songs that really connected with people in any way whatsoever, because they were, you know, songs about pain and struggle.
Yeah.
and desperation.
Do you think the best songs come from pain and struggle?
Yeah, I've been asking myself that question a lot. I mean, it was scary on the second album, trying to write. I'd been so used to writing from a place of extreme hurt and turmoil. Like, I didn't really know how to, I almost had to relearn how to write songs.
Yeah.
It's almost like I had this, you know, this burning coal fire that was just always pumping out creativity. And then as soon as that was out, and I'm like, I've lived the life for 2 years, hanging out with my best friends every day, you know, like with a gum on the road, driving around a little van from town to town, you know, endless parties, endless gigs. How could I be unhappy anymore? You know? So it was scary. I do feel like the first record, in many ways was more sort of soulful and genuine.
Yeah.
But you know, all I can do is try and find new avenues. I went down the route of nostalgia for the second record.
Yeah.
I really subscribe to that Bowie idea that the place that you're in has a huge amount of pull on your creative direction. And I spent my entire recording budget on a chateau in Wyandotte, California.
Nice.
Didn't write anything.
Wow.
You know, crashed into the fountain. That was like the most eventful thing that happened the whole time we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And then had to write the record in my friend's parents' house because we didn't have money for a studio. And so I think, like, you know, being in this house with my buddy who I started writing with when I was like, you know, a young teenager, just really brought back a lot of feelings and memories and nostalgia and missing being young.
Yeah.
And that ended up being album two.
Now, with album three, are you going to go back to the house, knock on the door, and be like, I got to write again, let me in?
Yeah. What do you mean you're sick of me already? It was really, Sam and I were literally going crazy, like in the fetal position. I might be exaggerating, underneath our chairs. Like, you know, imagine spending every day, all day with somebody and then going to bed and they're the first and last thing you see.
Yeah.
So to break up the monotony, we're going to this charity shop, and every day we would scout around the house for different ornaments that they had in the house. And then we would go to the charity shop and buy ornaments of sort of a similar ilk and strategically position
them.
All right. Slowly, my buddy Sam's dad was like, so many bloody ornaments around here. Bloody, Jane's always buying bloody. And then slowly, like, it just became more and more, you know, like a porcelain sailor. We'd have like a porcelain milkmaid or some, like, you know, crystal, three more crystal eggs.
Yeah. What is going on with all these ornaments?
And eventually we heard them arguing downstairs. We're like, well, I didn't buy them. Well, I didn't buy them. Well, I didn't buy them. You didn't buy them. Where did they come from?
Bonds!
Burst out. Yeah.
Somebody asked here, Falling Flux. Want to take a question from the fans. What's your recording studio setup? I literally have no idea where to start and money. So if you want to record, where do you start if you have no money?
I, first of all, would never record anything. I would just use my phone and make voice notes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, just know the songs on acoustic guitar. In fact, like, when I was really struggling and when I lost my first deal, I didn't have a laptop or anything. So, you know, all I had were the songs I could sing. And I remember I'd just kind of go around and, like, play them to people. And eventually I played it to a guy in the hotel lobby of the Ace Hotel in London. And it was really embarrassing because it's like a bar and everyone's looking and I'm like some random ass kid like playing this song.
Yeah.
And I played Fire. Like, okay, cool. Yeah, I like that. Come to my studio.
Wow.
And we'll record it. So I guess, yeah, if you have no money, as long as you got a guitar, it's just about consistently putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
Like again and again and again. And I think a lot of people, especially parents of a certain generation will try and discourage you from becoming a musician because it's so competitive. And they're right. Like, it is fucking competitive, and anything worth doing is. Mm-hmm. The only way that you can succeed in an industry like this is if you throw yourself into it 100% with like blinders on, tunnel vision, and decide and make a choice and say to yourself and write it down, like, I am not doing anything else until I make money from my music.
Yeah.
Tony Robbins, that motivational speaker from the 80s with all the sort of synth music in the background. He loves this story when they first arrived in South America, and they had a monumental task. They had to conquer South America and murder a bunch of indigenous people. So not that nice, but anyway, they had to do it, you know. So the general turned around and he got everybody off and ordered all the boats be burned so they couldn't get back home. You know, turned around to his men, right, look, so either we're going to win this thing, you guys are going to die.
Yeah.
And that, look at any major career goal. You have to make yourself uncomfortable, otherwise there won't be any growth. Look at major successes like Ed Sheeran, for instance. Like, there is a reason that that guy is one of the biggest solo artists in the world, whether you love him or hate him. It's because from the beginning, he always said, no matter how hard anybody works, I'll work harder. Mm-hmm. And when he was trying to get his start, he flew out to LA with literally no money, and he would play gigs. And at the end of every gig, he would say, hey, by the way, I don't actually have a place to stay, so if you like the show, can I please crash in your sofa? And he did this every night. And eventually Jamie Foxx was one of the guys in the crowd, saw him, was like, you're amazing. And he ended up staying on Jamie Foxx's couch for a couple of months.
What are the odds?
And like, you know, that, what exactly, what are the odds? They're ridiculous. But if you roll the dice enough times,
yeah,
if you go out there every night and you gamble again and again and again, it's just math. It's mm-hmm. just probability. And the problem is, first of all, most people who say that they want to do something don't really want it that bad, and they don't even try in the first place. Second of all, the people who do try don't try that hard, you know?
Yeah.
They're not like, they don't want it more than they want to party, more than they want to be cool, or more than they want to play video games or go out. You know, the people who are successful are the people who are grinding all day, every day. Yeah. Even somebody like Billie Eilish, who has tremendous natural talent, you can watch interviews. They had like the 10,000 hour rule posted up on their wall when they were kids.
Yeah.
And those two were grinding. When you whittle down, okay, take away the people that don't try because they're too scared. Take away the people that don't work that hard. Take away the people that aren't confident in themselves and not pushing their music out there. Take away the people that quit after they hit a few major failures in the road. And what you have is 100% of that last group of people are all successful. We love as humans to make things very complicated, and it's actually extremely simple. So sorry.
It's great advice. And the way you broke it down, you know, the people who don't work hard enough, the people that don't really have the passion. I mean, you really broke that down in a way I've never heard before. It's very inspiring.
You can absolutely, I'm telling you, I'm not being naive. I'm not simplifying things. I'm telling you 100%, even if you're like the worst singer in the world and you sound like a bag full of cats, you know what I mean? This is a muscle, like the muscles in your fingers. You can learn to sing.
Yeah.
Even if you don't have a good instrument, you know, if you've got a voice like Dylan, you know, you can still, with enough effort, you can find a niche and make that attractive.
Yeah.
Like, you think about who invented auto-tune, you know? Like, I wonder why they did that. Probably because they sucked at singing. And then that whole, like, genre in and of itself that was unique. There's all, I mean, this even applies to me, you know? It even applies to me because I want to be a successful musician, but I also love Assassin's Creed. And I love Netflix, you know? And I love going out with my friends. I spoke to one of Bleacher's roadies, and he was like, yeah, you know, that dude, he has a recording studio, like, in a rack, and every day we are instructed to load out the rack into his hotel room, and that guy doesn't leave his hotel room, like, at all. He's just 1975, the drummer is in the back of the bus all day, every day, producing it up, Maddie comes in, sing some shit over it. Mm-hmm. So by the time their tours are, they got like 100 demos.
Yeah.
It's so simple. And then you got me, you know? I'm on tour playing Super Smash Brothers with my bass player, going out drinking, you know, having a whale of a time. My career is at the exact level that I have calibrated it to be at. And if I want to get bigger, then I need to sort of work on my own willpower and ability. I've been waffling on for ages, but I will say finally on this particular topic, Benjamin Franklin said that we are the product of our habits. And it is so true. You know, if you are habitually doing one thing, positive or negative, that is a snapshot of your future.
So true.
Thank you for coming to
See ya. One more question. Is there something you want to see more of in the music industry?
I would love to see somebody reinvent guitar music the way that like Kendrick Lamar changed the game in rap. Mm-hmm. You know, like guitar music, like rock and roll has been stagnant for so, so long. I wish I could be like, that's me. I'm doing it.
This guy.
I mean, you know, I'll keep trying. Maybe this album will be the one. You don't know. But yeah, that's what I really love to see. I would love to see like the spirit and attitude of Led Zeppelin come back in a fresh. Now, Greta Van Fleet, love those guys. Amazing. So cool to see young kids playing guitar music and doing it so well and nailing it. But it's a copy of Zeppelin. Mm-hmm. I'd go to their show, buy their records. Love those guys. But it's not like, whoa, this is, I've never heard this before. This is a new sound for rock and roll.
Something brand new out of nowhere that just grabs everybody.
Yeah,
that would be cool. I think it's almost time for that.
Yeah, well, you know, you're seeing a resurgence in guitar music for sure, like with Greta Van Fleet that I mentioned, and then I think that artists like Youngblood are bringing back that idea. I mean, it's great to see somebody filling the massive vacuum that emo left when My Chemical Romance stopped playing. Like, I love that, and that kid's a genius, you know. The way that his whole project is put together is phenomenal. But yeah, it'd be really nice to see somebody just totally change the game.
What do you got planned for the rest of 2020?
I'm really grateful. You know, a lot of people are really struggling during this time, and it's really sad. I hate any situation in which people are put into danger and, you know, forced into a difficult mental space. But luckily for me, the lockdown's very similar to my actual creative process. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to be like away from people for long periods of time. And, you know, I got the studio set up here with my buddy Agam, and we're really good friends. And, you know, we just literally sit in the studio every day.
Yeah.
and make music. So I'm grateful because I tour so much, and I always feel like I have to rush my writing process, and then the next tour's coming up. So I'm very happy to be here and like have some time to breathe. And yes, I literally just sent an EP off for mix. So cool. Expect an EP coming out soon in the next couple of weeks.
And what's the word on touring right now for you and the record label and everything like that? With everything going on, is it kind of up in the air?
My agents that didn't expect to tour again for like at least another year.
Wow.
Said. It's hard to predict, isn't it?
Because yeah, it is.
We virus that we've never encountered before. Mm-hmm. But it is a coronavirus, and we do have a rough understanding of how those work.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what I would say is that it's very difficult to live in limbo and not know what's going on. It's much easier to accept this as your life at the moment, because you can take all of the things that made your life fulfilling on the outside and start to build those systems in your house. And I'm talking about, like, you know, the humans in general, we're growth seeking beings. We require some kind of movement in our lives to feel content. The reason I believe a lot of people are very strung out is because suddenly they're not going to work anymore. And there's, you know, sure, it might seem like what you want to do is get up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and watch TV all day and eat whatever you want. But actually, it's not fulfilling in a long term basis. I saw a great graph the other day that somebody drew up on YouTube about short-term and long-term satisfaction.
All right.
And he was basically like, when you satisfy your needs in the short-term benefit, your satisfaction levels go up temporarily, but then over a long period of time, eventually actually are much lower than where you started. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you build habits and routines for yourself that give you long-term satisfaction, you know, things like working out every day, or, you know, reading, or learning a new skill, then, you know, it's shitty at first because it's boring and your satisfaction and contentment down. In the long run, it actually directly mirrors short-term satisfaction. You end up here.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's really simple and genius. Why didn't I think of that? I should have just said that was me.
No, the graph was good. The graph was good. And then last...
I guess what I'm...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, so...
No, it's all you. I interrupted.
How dare you? Don't you know? I am bottom of the professionals. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, so we're growth-seeking beings. It's important to try and think, well, in your life outside of the house, what were you doing? You know, you were probably either a student and you were pursuing educational goals, or you're working and you were sort of moving up the ladder, or at least you had projects that were going on. Like, we need that in our lives. So choose a new skill to learn, or like think of a goal that you want to accomplish in the next month, and start planning out the steps of how you're going to get there. And what you'll find is suddenly the days become a lot less monotonous, and the feeling of stagnation suddenly becomes a feeling of movement, even though you're not physically going anywhere. And furthermore, in a very literal sense, just the small amount of exercise that we do every day, walking from A to B, we don't realize is giving us all these endorphins that we need to feel happy. Mm-hmm. So without that, being sat in the house, like, it's important. We got to exercise. I mean, I'm terrible at it, you know, like I don't work out. I'm not one of those buff guys off the television with a six pack, but as long as you're out of breath and you're sweating,
yeah,
you're getting those neurochemicals, that will last you for the whole day. Mm-hmm. And if you do that every morning, then you're golden. So, you know, there's just a whole myriad of different, a really good thing to look up and study is how inmates who are spending life in prison, like the ones that fare the best. And it's funny because, like, all the things I just mentioned, the ones that are the mentally sort of most happy and content, who have life sentences, yeah, you know, they work out every day. They're like, they're learning, they're reading books, some study yeah law, so they can try and contest their murder conviction.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
Others are, you know, training cockroaches to bring them cigarettes in solitary confinement.
Yeah. Whatever you got to work at to keep you happy.
Exactly.
And I'll end on a final question here, not a serious one. What is your favorite thing on the internet right now?
Oh, man. Can I say TikTok? Is that a thing?
I'm the same way. Exactly.
Oh, my God. I love TikTok.
It's scroll. Endless. Scroll. Scroll. Scroll.
Okay. But that's another one of those short-term satisfaction things.
Yep.
That this is science. Oh, you can look this up. Depletes your dopamine levels in your brain. Well, it doesn't. It gives you so many consistent hits of dopamine that your brain learns not to be content outside of that.
Yeah.
And it's like any drug. Like, the first hit is the best, and then the more you do it, the worse and worse it gets until you're depressed.
Yeah, you're just chasing that first one.
Chasing the dragon.
Yep, exactly. Dude, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. It's always nice talking to you.
Oh, man. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for letting me explain all of my views on things for the better part of 30 minutes.
Dude, anytime. It's always a pleasure sitting here and talking with you. And hopefully next time it won't be over a screen, but in person.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be snorting lines of ketamine.
Hell yes. A
couple of butter.
And everybody else who's watching, if you didn't catch the entire interview, it's going to be up at fm109radio.com. Barnes Courtney, I can't say thank you enough. You're the best, dude. We'll see you soon.
Thanks so much for having me. See ya.
Later, bro.